From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. September is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, an opportunity to have conversations about mental health and suicide, and of course, about prevention efforts. So let's start with some new research at Stanford that uses brain scans to develop potential treatments. I talked recently with Emily Underwood, a reporter for Science magazine. In an August 2019 article, she described neurological indicators that might lead to new treatments. I asked whether, in getting this assignment, Emily had been given direction to explore depression and suicide through science.
There's a tradition of studying neurobiological signatures of suicide that starts in the 80s. Depression and suicide are different things. It's important to keep in mind that most people who are depressed don't kill themselves, and many people who do don't have any psychiatric diagnosis.
You use the word neurological biomarkers or neurological signatures. What does that mean?
If you go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist and describe your symptoms, they're not going to take any blood tests or brain scans, most likely, unlike if you were to complain of a heart problem or lung problem. So many, many labs are looking for what they call biomarkers of mental illness, and that is a genetic variant or something in your blood or maybe a pattern of activity in your brain that can help to explain why you might be mentally ill or what might help you get better.
Is that part of this phrase that you use in your article that is precision psychiatry? What is that phrase and what does it mean?
Precision psychiatry is more of a goal and a hope than a reality, but researchers are gathering the data that they'll need to be able to make reliable predictions of what can help people.
Tell me about the research that's happening right now at Stanford, the project that you wrote about in your article.
Researchers at Stanford, led by Leanne Williams, are trying to parse all of the different subtypes of depression. She and her colleagues think that there are about six different kinds of depression. Other researchers have proposed additional types. But one of the studies that Dr. Williams is carrying out focuses on people who have a really hard time experiencing joy or pleasure in things that they used to find rewarding. That's a really classic symptom of depression. It's called anhedonia. So she is, you know, from a large group of people who have depression, really homing in on a subset who have extreme anhedonia and trying an experimental drug that focuses on what they think is the neurobiology of that symptom.
If I can jump back to the idea of different categories of depression, that means some groups or some people in those groups might respond to some treatments and in other cases not, correct?
That's exactly right. You know, one thing that most neuroscientists agree on is depression is not just one disease, but is made up of many different subtypes, and that these subtypes have something to do with dysfunction in different neural circuits. That's these linked circuits of neurons that regulate different behaviors. So, for example, there is one type of depression that may have to do with problems in a circuit called the default mode network. And the default mode network is active when your brain is sort of in idle. So it creates this chatter, the relentless negative thoughts that some people have, negative self-talk, that may be linked to the default mode network not functioning the way that it should. And they can pick that up in a brain scan.
In your article, Emily, you write whether such a targeted approach to depression, for example, can prevent suicide, isn't clear at this point. So researchers are jumping in with theories, but nobody's certain that this is where the ultimate answer will be.
To describe suicidal thoughts, suicidal behaviors, to understand them better, that's really the stage that scientists are at right now, not yet using that information to predict what will happen to a particular person. There are labs that are working towards that, but we're not there yet.
I want to get into the area of using brain scans to detect activity and somehow making that link to depression and suicide.
All brain activity, our feelings, our thoughts come from these linked circuits of neurons called neural circuits. And in depression, It's thought certain neural circuits either are hyperactive or not active enough, or that different hubs in the brain aren't talking to each other. Using brain scans, specifically, you know, functional fMRI, scientists can take a bird's eye look at the brain and see which areas of the brain are talking to each other and which aren't. So in the Stanford study, a participant in a study will go into a lab, get into an fMRI machine, and then do a series of tasks that are designed to activate these different networks. Some of the tasks have to do with rewards, like looking at a happy face. Some of the tasks test your concentration and ability to focus. When somebody runs through these different tasks, which the researcher describes as sort of a stress test for the brain, they can see if there are patterns that are hyperactive or underactive or normal, and they give somebody a score.
We were talking about different types of depression then. So do they show up differently in terms of a brain scan?
Yeah. These patterns are not something that a researcher could necessarily see with the naked eye, but they use really complicated computer algorithms to pick up differences in the activity that are different enough from sort of a normal baseline that they signal something might be wrong.
You interviewed a man named Mo who is undergoing treatment as part of the study at Stanford. Why was he a good candidate for this research? What's happening with him?
So Mo has a type of depression researchers think has to do with problems with the reward circuit. So, you know, when we eat a chocolate ice cream cone or go to the movies or do something we find pleasurable, those feelings are generated in part by activity in this circuit. Mo, for many years, has had a hard time enjoying much of anything. He used to be a pilot. He likes to play the guitar, or he did. And when he got sick, his enjoyment of those things really evaporated. Because his symptoms of anhedonia, which is this inability to experience joy and pleasure, mm-hmm. are so severe, he's a good candidate for one trial going on at Stanford that is using an experimental depression treatment called pramipexole. That drug acts like dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter that runs these reward circuits and gives us these rewarding sensations. So Mo's brain activity also reflects low activation in the reward circuit. So that, combined with his symptoms, his inability to sort of enjoy everyday life, makes him a good candidate for the trial.
You write that his brain scans match up so far with his clinical history. So what does that mean?
So the cool thing about this experiment is they can look at people who are really struggling to enjoy life and have high anhedonia, whose brain activity seems to support and reflect those symptoms. And then they can use a drug that is designed to target the abnormal brain activity and see if it actually makes them feel better, which would tell scientists that they're on the right track.
What are these scientists ultimately trying to figure out or do?
They're trying to reduce the trial and error and sort of long waiting periods that people have to endure when they go to seek treatment for depression.
And try different medicines.
Right. It's not unusual to have to try several different types of antidepressant drugs and maybe different kinds of therapy. Maybe you do both therapy and an antidepressant at the same time, but it's pretty common for people to take months or longer than that to find relief. And then for people like Mo, nothing may work.
You did talk to Mo along the way, and since his treatment has begun, what's happening in his life, in his case?
Mo had a pretty remarkable response to this drug. He'd only been taking it for a couple of weeks when I talked to him, so it's too early to know if this is going to be a solution for him in the long term. But he, for the first time in years, told me he felt hope. And he enjoyed listening to songs that he used to love when he was in college. They made him tear up. He, you know, felt sort of the full spectrum of human emotions, which had been inaccessible to him for a long time.
I don't know if there can be a summary to your reporting, because it seems that each piece of it is just that. It's just a piece of it right now. But what did you walk away from this experience and learning thinking yourself?
I think that this fine scaled understanding of what each individual person's depression is all about has huge potential for helping us understand ourselves, for getting people to the treatments they need much earlier. My hope is just that once it reaches its potential, that it will be available to lots and lots of people.
Sometimes the subjects of depression and suicide get lumped together. Why is that not a good idea in the conversation?
You know, the brain biology of suicide, you know, what little is known about it at this point, turns out to be quite different from depression. There is some overlap, but you know, this makes sense if you think about the fact that most people who are depressed don't attempt suicide, don't kill themselves. And, you know, many people who do don't have any detectable mental illness. One difference between the brains of people who have died by suicide and people who are depressed but die a different way is that people who die by suicide tend to have much lower levels of the neurotransmitter serotonin mm-hmm. in their brain tissue. That's something that was discovered in the 80s by looking at the brain tissue of people after they died. More recently, scientists have found that people who are chronically, constantly plagued by suicidal thoughts also have low serotonin. The neurobiology looks different from people who tend to have more suicidal impulses when they are stressed. So it looks like there's some difference even within suicide between people who get laid off and are feeling extremely upset and are tempted to kill themselves versus somebody who really can't get out from underneath that feeling.
That research and understanding of serotonin drove a whole field of treatment choices and treatment developments. Do you get the sense that we're in a new frontier where we may again see a whole new field of options and treatments and medications to deal with depression, and I'll separate it from suicide or the mix of both?
I think that the emphasis on circuits rather than specific neurotransmitters like serotonin is really important. So they're looking at overall brain activity and these imbalances in communication between different brain areas, as opposed to just focusing on a molecule like serotonin or a molecule like dopamine. The idea is to tune these circuits so that the brain functions better as a whole.
That was Science Magazine reporter Emily Underwood. We've posted links to her story, which is headlined, "Brain Scans Could Help Personalize Treatment for People Who Are Depressed or Suicidal." That link is at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio.